The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Ah, it's finally Friday! Yes, we've made it almost to the weekend. Let's start off the weekend with a little rock and roll from Boca Brittany Summers and Burning Their Shoes. You know who this one goes out to, don't you? Thought you did.
On pigmentation, so for the world to see how intervene. Then all the whitey brighty said he's got a lot of nerve. That is to say, the racist honky's too afraid to serve. And they're burning their shoes. They're burning their shoes. Could afford whiteies. Could afford Nikes. Nike says do it with a match and some fluid. But before you do, make sure you pay for the shoes. The Hawks unite to express their bigoted plight. Kaepernick ain't got no right to constitutional rights. And they're burning their shoes.
The most idiotic response that I saw to any of the crazy stuff that goes on in around the news these days was on Facebook, pictures of people burning their Nikes while they're still on their feet. And then the pictures of the burnt feet, in the emergency room. Really stupid. So Boca Britt getting us going with a bit of humor on this Friday. There's a lot going on today, isn't there? I'll try to put it all in perspective. Today's Friday, so thank goodness we've got the weekend here. Tomorrow happens to be the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Now, 10 years ago, I missed the anniversary a couple of weeks ago. It was on the 22nd of April, 22nd of August. That was my, the 10th anniversary of my being fired by the then progressive talk station here in South Florida, WINZ, 940 Winds, they called it, to make way for a format change to sports. I remember it so clearly because it was the Friday right before the Democratic National Convention was kicking off on Monday. And I had just gave all the plans of who we were going to talk to on the ground and how we were going to cover the convention. And the minute my mic went off, the door to the studio opened and it was my boss, the program director, who said, "Oh, come down to my office. Let's talk." And I knew something was up right then because he never would come into the studio like that. So sure enough, I go down and I'm told that, you know, my services are no longer needed. What I found out they were doing was, they had to wait for the Fox Sports, format to be released by another station in town, because Clear Channel owns Fox Sports, go figure, or iHeartMedia now. It's no longer Clear Channel. Anyway, they still had a few months before they could flip to sports, so they replaced my Progressive Talk morning show with Imus, of all things. Yeah. So, so I had been fired. It was the 22nd of August, and then it was just a couple of 2 to 3 weeks later that everything crashed, starting with the fall of Lehman Brothers. Now, I am not good when it comes to economics. Never studied economics in school. You might recall I've had one of my favorite guests is Stephanie Kelton, because she's so smart, and she's an economist. And she's one of the big proponents of modern monetary theory. And I've had her on the show a few times to try to explain in terms that even someone like I could understand. So we'll get her, back on the show again one of these days. But I bring it up because to let you know that I'm in over my head today. All right. I knew I wanted to do something to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the financial meltdown. You know, something that, for all the talk on behalf of the pundits and the government, how great the economy is. Some of us don't have any money in the stock market, so I don't care how well the stock market is doing. That to me doesn't signal a great economy. The jobless rate is down, lower than it's been in a decade or more. But there are still people. And I haven't been actively looking for a job because there are no jobs for me. I mean, this is my job. I do this every day, and you guys pay my salary by way of donations and contributions to the cause. But the last time I had a regular full-time job with benefits, you know, and a salary, I lost that 10 years ago, a couple of weeks ago. And then when the crash hit, there were no jobs. Now, with the so-called recovery, there are jobs, but wages have not gone up. And in many industries, the jobs are just gone. Nice of Trump to say, you know, he wants to bring back coal mining jobs. Dreams. I'd like to bring back radio jobs like they were, 25 years ago. Yeah, because they don't exist. They've all with consolidation. You used to have one program director, music director, all the air talent, a promotions person for each radio station. Now they have 7 or 8 stations under one roof in a market. They'll let one program director program 2 or 3 stations. They have some of the talent, the disc jockeys, as it were, voice tracking shifts in other cities. All through the magic of, digital transmissions. All the music is pre-programmed. It's a different world. So where there used to be inside any given radio station at least 20 jobs, now there are some radio stations that don't have any local employees. Seriously. So the economy may have come back in certain sense, but a lot of the jobs are gone. My job, jobs in music radio, were largely taken over by automation. As I said, voice tracking from one city to another. The programming jobs were, everything was consolidated, and the jobs just don't exist. And where the jobs do exist, they, the salaries suck because they never rose. Anyway, so knowing that the 10th anniversary of the 2008 financial meltdown was coming, I wanted to do something to cover it. And I told you the other day that I get a lot of books because I do interview authors, although I'm fairly choosy about which authors I choose to interview. Sometimes I read the book, sometimes I don't. Well, I got sent this book. It's called Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And this is a big honking book. I'm not exaggerating. This is a big, big book. It runs, just in terms of the book itself, I think 601 pages of the regular text. And then there's almost another 100 pages of footnotes and index. That's how serious this author, Adam Tooze, is. I think it's pronounced Tooze. We'll find out when we talk to him. Anyway, so I'm going to talk to somebody who is just an expert in the field of economics, who's been writing about this, teaching. He's a professor, and I know nothing. So I will do I will give him the layman's interview to try to make it so that we can all understand what happened 10 years ago and where we still are now. So we'll get into that. I promise it won't be as, you know, usually when I hear talks about economics, my eyes roll back in my head, I space out, but I'll be doing the interview. So I'll have to make it, the questions have to be relatable so that I can understand them. And if I can understand them, you'll understand them. Okay. How a decade of financial crises changed the world. I know how my world's been changed in the last 10 years. That's for sure. All right. Well, before we get to any of that, there is a lot of news going on today. A lot has changed since this morning when I recorded What's New. So we'll do the live version of What's News starting now.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, Hurricane Florence made landfall near Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina this morning at about 7:15 as a Category 1 storm with estimated maximum winds of 90 miles per hour. The storm had already hit some areas hard overnight. In New Bern, North Carolina, emergency officials fielded more than 100 calls from people trapped in their cars or homes had water coming into their homes. More than 300,000 homes also lost power.
Most of the power here is out. The city manager, Mike Kramer, says that there are reports of some minor damage, nothing dramatic so far. And as is the case up and down the coast, this is a slow mover, moving about 5-6 miles an hour. So the mantra is flow, flow, go, go, go. Whoa, that wind is blowing.
I know the feeling well. For once, I'm really sorry for the people of the Carolinas and Virginia and Georgia and everywhere else that's going to get impacted. But speaking as a Floridian, thank you, Florence, for not hitting us here. The massive storm with a zone of tropical storm force winds nearly 400 miles wide will slowly drift inland over the weekend. Forecasters say that catastrophic flooding is expected. Sending out our thoughts and prayers to everyone in the way of the storm. And I hope you heeded the warnings and got out. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo survived a primary challenge from actress Cynthia Nixon last night. In her concession speech, Nixon said her campaign had fundamentally changed the political landscape in New York.
My hat is off to each and every one of you and the brilliant insurgent campaigns that you have run. Your victories tonight have shown that the blue wave is real and that it is not only coming for Republicans, it is coming for Democrats who act like them. In our campaign, we took on one of the most powerful governors in America, and it wasn't easy. We had to fight just to get on the ballot. We had to fight just to get a debate.
Yep.
And we started with nothing, and we earned every single vote. And while the result tonight was not what we hoped for, I am not discouraged. I am inspired, and I hope you are too.
Yeah.
This race for the Democratic nomination may be over, but the fight for the soul of the Democratic Party is just beginning.
Well, in fast-moving news today, this has changed a few times since I wrote the first story at about 7 this morning. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort has reached a plea deal with a special counsel team led by Robert Mueller. The reported deal came after Manafort's conviction last month in Virginia on 8 counts of tax and bank fraud and ahead of his next scheduled trial on additional federal charges. MSNBC had a really good discussion on what this all means.
Special counsel Robert Mueller has filed a massive criminal information against Paul Manafort that suggests that he's going to walk into this courthouse and plead guilty to two counts, conspiracy to defraud the United States and witness tampering. Those counts incorporate some of the charges that he was charged with in Washington, D.C., and he was set to go on trial next week in that case. Mm-hmm. And as part of this criminal information, he is admitting essentially to the kitchen sink, Hallie, to all the conduct that the government has charged him with in both the Washington, D.C. and Virginia. All the conduct involving failure to register as a foreign lobbyist, money laundering. But he's only pleading guilty to two counts. Mm-hmm. Now, our legal analyst, Daniel Goldman, has suggested that that could indicate that he has cut a deal to cooperate with Robert Mueller, but we just don't know the answer to that question. We may learn it later today, or we may not, Hallie.
Ken, you mentioned Dan Goldman. He is joining us now from New York, our MSNBC legal analyst and former assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. And let me just also mention here, Dan, Paul Manafort, upon entering his guilty plea, is expected to forfeit a number of assets, including his house in the Hamptons, a property in New York City, a property in Brooklyn, a property in Alexandria, Virginia, just across the river from where we are. He's also forfeiting all the money in four of the banking accounts that he has. So this is all expected coming to a head at 11 when, by the way, it is now going to be a plea agreement hearing. That is the official language from the court and from the special counsel's office. So, Dan, what is the significance of this?
It's quite significant, Hallie. Ken hit the nail on the head. What's interesting about this in reading the document that was filed by the special counsel's office this morning, which is a criminal information, which is the same as an indictment, but that Paul Manafort is waiving his right to have a grand jury Woo-hoo! Vote on the indictment, and therefore he's allowing this information to be filed. And what's interesting about it is, it, as Ken said, it includes almost all of the conduct, if not all, of the conduct that he's charged with in the D.C. case. But notably, what sticks out to me is it also includes some conduct that he was only charged with in the Virginia case and on which the jury hung. And the benefit that he seems to be getting, at least from this charging document, is that the sentence is going to be capped, a statutorily maximum cap of 10 years. It's two counts of conspiracy. So it includes all of his criminal conduct, but they dropped a number of the counts that would have blown up his statutory maximum, which means that he cannot be sentenced in the D.C. case for more than 10 years. The judge in D.C., if there's no cooperation, the judge in D.C. would have the option of running that sentence concurrently, which means at the same time as his sentence in Virginia. So what Paul Manafort, at a minimum, is getting here is a somewhat of a cap on what his ultimate sentence could be. But the interesting thing, as Ken pointed out, is whether or not he is going to be cooperating with Robert Mueller. He could just be entering into a plea agreement where he agrees to plead to all these charges and then just gets his benefit of that I just discussed. Or if he wants to actually reduce his sentence, the only way to do that through the criminal justice system is through cooperation. And that's what we're waiting to see. But as I read this, Hallie, it, because it includes all of his conduct, including some conduct in Virginia, this reads to me like it could be cooperation.
And since that discussion took place, we have found out that, yes, it is cooperation. Paul Manafort is cooperating with Robert Mueller. Investigation. He's already spoken to them. More and more has come out in the last couple of hours in this quickly changing story. Jeffrey Toobin on CNN last night, I think this was last night, had a really good explanation of why Manafort appears to have flipped and told prosecutors what he knows.
He has been convicted once. He is looking at likely being convicted again, both in the retrial in Virginia and in the other trial in the District of Columbia. He is looking at a disastrous scenario, plus, of course, the legal fees and stress involved in going to trial again. The prosecutors are there. They're ready to try this case. They'll try it. It's not going to cost them anything extra. So all the leverage is on the prosecutor's side. To give him any sort of deal, they are going to have to get something in return. And the only thing he could really offer at this point is cooperation. And whether he has had a proffer session with them, meaning telling them what he would say if he did cooperate, that's something, you know, we don't know, but is a very important question. And, it would be a cooperation deal at this point would serve both sides. It would not serve Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and it would hurt Paul Manafort's chances of getting a pardon if he cooperates. But, We don't know whether he's in line for a pardon.
And what we've learned is that there won't be any pardon coming. I called Marcy Wheeler to try to get her to come on with us. She's in high demand today. So let me share with you her latest post on this. The headline at emptywheel.net reads, "Checkmate. The Manafort cooperation is pardon proof." Pardon proof. Here's what she wrote. "I was virtually certain that the plea deal Manafort is pleading today would include cooperation, and I was correct. Andrew Weissman told Amy Berman Jackson that the deal does require Manafort cooperation. I was certain not just because of the tease in the special counsel announcement above that additional information would be forthcoming, but the fact that no media outlet was able to confirm whether or not the plea would include cooperation could only be possible if Mueller had made silence about that fact part of the deal. Otherwise, Manafort's lawyers would have confirmed that it included no cooperation to placate the president. As it was, no one outside of the deal knew that the plea did include cooperation until Manafort was already pleading guilty. And at this point, the deal is pardon proof. That was part of keeping the detail secret to prevent a last-minute pardon from Trump undercutting it." And she continues, "This is why the deal is pardon proof. One, Mueller spent the hour and a half delay in arraignment doing something. It's possible Manafort even presented the key parts of testimony Mueller needs from him to the grand jury this morning. Number two, the forfeiture in this plea is both criminal and civil, meaning the Department of Justice will be able to get Manafort's $46 million even with a pardon. And three, some of the dismissed charges are financial ones that can be charged in various states." Again, Marcy Wheeler wrote, "Remember, back in January, Trump told friends and aides that Manafort could incriminate him. The implication was that only Manafort could. I believe Mueller needed Manafort to describe what happened in a June 7th, 2016 meeting between the men in advance of the June 9th meeting. I have long suspected there was another meeting at which Manafort may be the only other Trump aide attendee. And Manafort has probably already provided evidence on whatever Mueller needed. So here's what Robert Mueller just did. He sewed up the key witness to implicate the president, and he paid for the entire investigation. And it's only now lunchtime." So that's from Marcy Wheeler over at emptywheel.net. She's got more on it, but that's what you needed to know. So that's the latest I can tell you about the Mueller-Manafort deal. And there is a deal. You know what I screwed up before when I gave you the story about Andrew Cuomo surviving the primary challenge from Cynthia Nixon? I neglected to tell you about what else happened in New York last night. And the other race that, many of us were watching even more closely than the governor's race, because the governor's race, we kind of knew Cuomo was going to win again. In the Democratic primary for attorney general, this was a tough one. It was a four-way race. It was actually only a three-way race, and it was a tight three-way race. But New York City's public advocate Letitia James beat out her three rivals, including progressive Zephyr Teachout, which really kind of sucks. However, there's still good news. Progressives dominated contests in the state legislature. Progressive primary challengers effectively ended the Independent Democratic Conference. That's a coalition of Democrats who conferenced with Republicans to block Democratic control of the state legislature. And it was done with Cuomo's consent. Well, that has now been broken up. And so now Democrats will run the Democratic majority legislature in New York. There's another big story, too, that some of us, well, we're all trying to wrap our hands around, and we've gotten inklings of it over the last few weeks. Senator Dianne Feinstein acknowledged yesterday that she has a document concerning Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh that she has refused to share, despite behind-the-scenes requests to do so from fellow Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Rachel Maddow explained more about this very weird story.
The top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein, released a short but jarring statement. Quote, "I have received information from an individual concerning the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. That individual strongly requested confidentiality, declined to come forward, or to press the matter further. I have honored that decision. However, I have referred the matter to federal investigative authorities." We reached out to Senator Feinstein's office tonight. They would not provide us any information beyond that statement. News outlets, starting with Ryan Grimm at The Intercept, later BuzzFeed, then The New York Times, The Washington Post, now NBC News, are all reporting that Senator Feinstein first became aware of whatever this information is, thanks to a letter. The New York Times tonight reporting that this letter was sent in July, first to the office of a California Democratic congresswoman, Anna Eshoo. Congresswoman Eshoo then reportedly relayed the letter to Senator Feinstein's office. The New York Times reports that last night, Senator Feinstein told her fellow Democrats on the Judiciary Committee about the existence of this letter and its contents, though she didn't actually share the actual letter. The Times reports that several of these Democratic senators that Feinstein spoke with advised her that she needed to take these claims to the FBI. And now she has done so. The FBI, for its part, says, yes, they received this information, and they say they have forwarded it to the White House to be part of Judge Kavanaugh's background file. NBC News reports late tonight, quote, two sources say the allegation in the letter was sexual in nature.
Yep.
But both sources said the letter writer was not specific in describing Kavanaugh's alleged behavior. One source tells NBC the conduct described in the letter could amount to an allegation of sexual assault or a lesser allegation, and added the individual making the allegation would have to be more specific with law enforcement officials for any investigation to be able to move forward.
But the problem is the person who wrote the letter, that who told about this alleged assault or something close to an assault, does not want her name to be public. Therein lies the problem. This is alleged to have been from Kavanaugh's high school days. Now, if somebody, you know, commits rape in high school, or, you know, sexual assault, which it sounds like it was one or the other, should that be something that precludes them from, getting their dream job when they're 53 years old? Well, if it's rape, yeah, I don't know. So this one is to be continued. That's about all we know right now. I just know that this story isn't over yet. All right. We've got this interview coming up. That's pretty much it for news. I mean, there's all kinds of other stuff going on, and it's Friday, so you know anything could happen between now and 6 o'clock, as it often does on Friday afternoons in this day and age. But we're going to shift onto the crashed economy and the book Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. We'll talk to the author of the book, Adam Tooze, in just a few minutes. Before we get to something that heavy, you know what? Let's make fun of Trump a little more. Okay.
The president has been going on TV basically every day to try to convince people that he's competent as a potentially devastating hurricane bears down on the East Coast. Lately, he's taken to posting videos to Twitter, but it's clear from the quality of these videos that he's just making his staffers point a camera at him while he rambles off the top of his head. Yesterday, for example, he tried to reassure people that his government was ready for Hurricane Florence.
Hurricane Florence is fast approaching. It's going to be here over the next 48 hours. We'll handle it. We're ready. We're able. We've got the finest people, I think, anywhere in the world. Get out of its way. Don't play games with it. It's a big one. We are ready. But despite that, bad things can happen when you're talking about a storm this size. It's called Mother Nature. You never know, but we know.
Oh, my God.
That video is like a local news report where the meteorologist called in sick and the sports guy had to fill in at the last minute.
Yep.
The hurricane came to play, but the first responders left it all out on the field. In the end, it comes down to turnovers.
If you want people to take your message seriously, maybe have higher production quality than a mid-level YouTube star.
The storm is big. Get out of the way. But before you do, please like and subscribe.
And if that didn't do enough, that didn't do enough to relieve people's worst fears, the White House also released this photo of Trump on the phone while Chief of Staff John Kelly and Vice President Mike Pence look at some printouts. Oh, well, that's reassuring. They look like they're ordering Chinese food.
I'll go ahead and dial. You guys just pick four or five things that we could share.
And as a life-threatening storm bears down on the East Coast, Trump has also been bragging about his handling of the humanitarian disaster in Puerto Rico, which left nearly 3,000 American citizens dead. Now, that is the official death toll from an independent study commissioned by Puerto Rico's government, and yet our deranged president doesn't believe it.
He says 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. When I left the island after the storm had hit, they had anywhere from 6 to 18 deaths. As time went by, it did not go up by much. Then a long time later, they started to report really large numbers like 3,000. He then says in a second tweet, this was done by Democrats in order to make me look as bad as possible when I was successfully raising billions of dollars to help Puerto Rico. If a person died for any reason, like old age, just add them onto the list. Bad politics. I love Puerto Rico.
That's the official death toll, you lunatic. Now we know why he's so orange. His brain is just melted pumpkin guts.
Melted pumpkin guts. Yeah, works for me. All right.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right. We're back. And now let me, I'm going to get our guest on the line. Adam Tooze, I think is how we pronounce his name. We'll find out for sure when he picks up, is a professor of history at Columbia University. He's also an internationally renowned scholar and, the award-winning author of numerous books, who has proven himself a skilled analyst of hugely complex political and economic issues. And hopefully he'll answer the phone. His brand new book is titled Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World, and hopefully he'll answer the phone. it sounds like I'm getting voicemail. Uh-oh.
Please leave your message for 20341.
Let's try him one more time. 203. All right, we're going to try him one more time. I hate when this happens. This is the drawback of working without a producer.
Hello.
Hey, Adam.
Hi, I'm here, yeah.
Hi, Adam. It's Nicole Sandler calling from The Nicole Sandler Show. How are you doing today?
I am very well, thank you. Sorry for cutting it a bit fine.
Oh, no problem at all. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Is it Tooze?
It's Tooze.
Tooze. Adam,
like
Tooze.
Two with a Z on the end, Tooze.
Got it. Okay, so we're live on the air. I work alone without a producer, so we sort of fly by the seat of our pants here. I was telling the listeners about who you are, a professor of history at Columbia University, an internationally renowned scholar, an award-winning author of numerous books, and as such, you've proved yourself a skilled analyst of hugely complex political and economic issues. Your brand new book is titled Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And Adam, I've got to admit, I'm in way over my head here. Because normally when I talk about things relating to economics, my eyes roll back in my head. But I try. Stephanie Kelton has been on my show a few times and got me sort of understanding what modern monetary theory is. I think I have a...
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow, you're feeding on the deep end then. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I got a little bit here. This is a big book in more ways than one that tells the story of the 2008 financial crisis and its causes and effects. So tomorrow actually marks the 10th anniversary of the fall of Lehman Brothers. Is that right?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely. It's the anniversary of the bankruptcy.
That's so can we pinpoint the whole 2008 meltdown to that moment, or was it more of a slow moving disaster, sort of like, you know, the hurricane hanging out over the Carolinas for a few days?
Yeah, I mean, slow moving, it didn't feel slow moving, I think, for the people involved, but I totally, yes, your point is absolutely spot on. This didn't start with Lehman. It started in 2007 when the real estate bubble began to unravel. European banks started failing early already in August 2007. Lehman is, in some ways, I think, almost a sort of You know, it serves as a symbol of the crisis rather than being in and of itself the driver of that crisis. Plenty of banks were in such profound trouble that they needed bailing out with or without Lehman's failure. And even if Lehman had been saved as opposed to being allowed to fail, they would still have been in such serious trouble that they would have needed bailing too. So what Lehman did do, however, was to send a very confusing signal to markets so that they no longer understood whether the American authorities would or would not bail banks, because they bailed Bear Stearns, they bailed Sandy Mae and Freddie Mac, and all of a sudden they let Lehman go, and then the FDIC let Washington Mutual fail as well. So there was a real sense of uncertainty that Lehman brought in. And it was systemically interconnected with the rest, particularly of the investment banking community. So it going down really did cause havoc in the week and the weeks afterwards.
Sure. Now, with all that going on, that set off a whole bunch of other, I guess, dominoes, financial dominoes around the world. You describe the book as, this is a quote, an exploration of the mechanism that tore the world apart and the reason why that disintegration came as such a surprise. Did it come as a surprise, or were people predicting a big crash coming, that there was too big of a housing bubble?
Well, it's really interesting. The housing bubble itself went largely unmolested by criticism until quite a late stage. People really bought into it. You can point to individual mavericks who, of course, raised their voices and were then quickly hushed up. But at the same time, and to me this is a really kind of one of the real shocks of doing the work for this book, was to discover there was this very large community of very serious macroeconomists who were, in fact, predicting a crisis before 2008, just it wasn't the right crisis. So it's not just, as it were, that the Cassandras were silent who were pointing to the real estate bubble and saying, look, this could go bad. But at the same time, a group of very influential voices were saying, here's a crisis that's going to blow the world apart. And it was the crisis they supposed would happen between China and the United States. America had enormous trade deficit. The Chinese owned a lot of American government debt. They still do. This not surprisingly raises the fear that at some point the Chinese might lose patience with America and sell all this debt. And when that happens, the dollar plunges and American interest rates surge. And so that was really the big fear in 07 and 08, all the way through the winter of that final winter before the crisis. Indeed, it's through to the spring of 2008. If you look at the front cover of The Economist magazine or Spiegel in Germany, the big weekly there, you know, big headlines about how the dollar was going to collapse. And of course, that's not what happened at all. The Chinese held still. The dollar, in fact, became more valuable in the course of the financial crisis because all the banks in the world needed dollars. And what really did implode were the banks. The banking system on either side of the Atlantic suddenly suffered an absolutely massive heart attack.
So it did. It all originated here. It was our. It was the subprime mortgage scam that.
Well, the American bit was most interconnected, and the Europeans had bought into it in a big time, in a big way. But in Ireland and Spain, there were real estate bubbles even bigger than in the United States, which were bursting as well. And Ireland is small, but Spain isn't. Spain is a Texas-sized lump in the Eurozone economy. And so the implosion of the real estate market there was going to have a very big effect on a very large economy, whether or not the crisis happened in the United States. In fact, they were all interconnected by means of the same money markets, which fund all of the global banks in the same way. And so uncertainty in one market jumped into the other and shut down funding there and caused a contraction in movement across the North Atlantic economy.
Wow. You know, I again, with my very naive understanding of economics and the way big money works, I've had an idea for all these 10 years of what I think would have been the better way to get us out of this mess without crashing the entire world's economy. And so, Adam Tooze, I'd love to know what you think of this idea that, you know, my husband and I have bandied this about a lot. I was caught up in the crash. I had just been fired from my full-time job at the Miami's then progressive talk station as they were preparing to flip it to sports, because, you know, we need three or four sports talk stations in Miami and no progressive talk, right? At the same time, the value of my home had plummeted. I had just bought my sister out of the house that was my father's. I had my savings wrapped up in the house. I eventually lost the house and my life savings, which were invested in it. I always wondered how much better we'd have been if the TARP funds, instead of just going straight to the banks, was distributed to homeowners to pay down their mortgages. The banks would have gotten the money in the end anyway, but millions of Americans wouldn't have lost everything in the big mortgage scam. Am I crazy to think that that would have been a much more sensible way out of this?
This is, in a sense, the great what-if of the Obama presidency. Because the bailouts of 2008 were done, after all, by a Bush administration with Democratic votes in Congress.
Right. Yep.
And the question really is why there was, no radical program with a completely different orientation, precisely of the type that you were talking about after 2009. And I think there are a variety of different factors in play here. The question is a very legitimate one and hotly debated amongst extremely serious, economists and political operatives. So I think this is no harebrained scheme. This is a sensible idea in many ways. The problem is that it's political, really, in the broadest sense of the word. Doing any of these kind of measures is quite a big ask for a political system, because basically you're going to redistribute resource.
Right.
What you would be asking for is for the people who had made bad bets for whatever reason, good reason or bad, family circumstances, whatever it is, to be in some way supported by the rest of the American taxpayers. And we know when that proposal was put, what happened, which is that the Tea Party emerged. The Tea Party is not a protest party against bailing out the banks. It's an anti-welfarist movement. And so the political cost of doing this is high. So then the question is, does it make sense for the Obama administration to pay that political price in 2009? And there are different, questions that bear on that. One is, do you have other legislative priorities? And the decision made by the Obama team is that healthcare is the top priority for ordinary Americans, for all ordinary Americans. That's what they really need to get through, on top of the stimulus, which will create work and put you back in a job, or millions of other Americans like you who are struggling to find work. So their two top legislative priorities are stimulus and healthcare. And with that agenda set, the question is, do we have enough political capital to get the sort of proposal that you're talking about through? And the answer is, well, no, this is probably stretching beyond what we can do. Mm-hmm. And so then the next question will be, well, it might be still worth making that gamble if we were certain it would work. What kind of dimensions would it have to have, and when would it begin to act? And the thing about a bank bailout is it's more or less instant in its effect, or it works over a matter of weeks or months. Between September 2008 and May 2009, the American banking system went from being dead in the water to more or less back on its feet again. Now, doing the sort of proposal that you're talking about would take years to operationalize, because you'd have to evaluate every single individual case. Mm-hmm. You'd have to figure out what the right valuations were. You can understand the logistics. And the Obama administration did have a variety of more or less ineffective proposals that were working along these lines, but they simply don't work quickly enough to have really much positive economic effect. So if you think about the huge political price you pay and the modest economic benefit protracted over a very long period of time, well beyond the immediate acute phase of the crisis, then you can see why they pulled back from the idea, even though from a personal position and from the point of view you might think of sort of a politics of redistribution, a progressive politics, this is an extremely attractive idea.
Absolutely. There's the other complication. So people who are homeowners who are struggling, or whether they were struggling or not, people who were homeowners are in my plan are the ones who would have gotten the money. Well, then you're going to have another big part of the population who aren't homeowners saying, "Well, what about me?"
Exactly.
Why?
So it becomes very arbitrary, right? And why, are you just struggling enough to qualify or not struggling?
Right.
You can imagine the cutoff questions that will be raised across the board. And so then, more general policies of supporting the entire economy through stimulus, for instance, seem, more viable.
Yes.
Politically, which is the route they went down. And then eventually also, of course, the quantitative easing of the Federal Reserve, which in an even more diffuse and indirect way provided stimulus to the entire economy. I mean, this is one of the great sort of, the incredibly painful things about a crisis like this is it generates acute distress in specific parts of the population. and the mechanisms for relieving that stress can be extraordinarily indirect and may, in fact, in various ways, benefit extremely affluent people who are, you know, the least deserving of public support.
Right.
But that may be the most effective way of supporting and the most politically viable way of supporting the entire economy. There's no doubt, I think, one should take the testimony of the Obama veterans seriously, that they felt this dilemma extremely acutely, even if we may second guess the choices they eventually made.
Right. Yeah. Well, this wound up being the largest peacetime effort ever undertaken to bail out the banks, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yep. And in terms of central bank action as well, the most extraordinary and unprecedented expansion of central bank capacity that we've ever seen. No, this is a remarkably radical period of economic policy.
We're speaking with Adam Tooze, author of the brand new book, Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. So you talk about what led up to the crash and then in the aftermath. And if I'm reading correctly, it seems like you're placing the blame for a lot of things on the crash. A lot of things grew out of the crash, from the rise of Putin, China's economic surge, the Eurozone crisis, Brexit, and even Trump's election. You say the crash led to all of these things?
Well, no, I don't, in fairness. I mean, if you'll forgive the analogy, it's more like, being in the studio of a music production.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do in Crash is just, turn up the bass line, basically.
Right.
That isn't to deny that, Putin's a political soloist in his own right, and he plays his own tune.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not driven by the financial crisis. But the financial crisis provides Putin with opportunities, moments for action, which he seizes. And he is enabled to do that, not by the crisis, but by the huge profits for the Russian economy produced by globalization. Russia is rebuilt as a power on the back of its sales of gas and oil to the global markets, which China is draining of resources. So the point of the book is not to insist that everything that's happened since 2008 is driven by the crisis, but in the way of in the manner of a remix of a music track, to say the whole thing sounds differently, appears differently, if you increase the volume on this particular part of the story. And then all of a sudden you can see interconnections and interrelationships you can't any other way. So with regard to Ukraine, for instance, mm-hmm. widely cited as an instance of Putin's aggression, which of course it is. But the question, of course, is what put Ukraine in harm's way? Why was it so fragile? Why is it so easy for Russia to muscle in? And the answer to that is the financial crisis is a very big part of what destabilizes Ukraine from 2008 onwards. Many people won't be aware that Ukraine was the economy most severely hit by the financial crisis. It's one of the earliest countries to fall back into an IMF program. And without that kind of background, it's very difficult to understand what presented Putin with his opportunity.
Okay. I understand. And he's been, it seems like he's just been quietly plotting, throughout the end of the Cold War days reemerge.
Plotting maybe, but certainly not quietly.
No.
He told us exactly what he was going to do. we just refused to take him seriously. Munich Security Conference, early 2007, Putin makes a extraordinary speech, is well worth reading, and I quoted at some length in the book, simply saying that he was drawing a red line. And he was now increasingly impatient with the United States expansionism and Europe's expansionism in Eastern Europe, the former zone and sphere of influence of the Soviet Union, that he did not feel taken seriously or treated with respect by the Western powers, that he thought their unilateralism was intolerable and was in fact destabilizing to the world. And when the Bush administration nevertheless pushed forward with promises to Ukraine and Georgia that they would get on a fast track to NATO accession, Putin responded by punishing Georgia, and this is another anniversary
right.
which we're celebrating right now, with a war. The Georgians were then foolish enough even to give him the opportunity to do this and found themselves humiliated militarily in August 2008, just before the financial
wow.
crisis started. So, Putin has quite explicitly formulated a contrary position to our very dramatic expansion of Western power since the end of the Cold War. He's made very clear what his red lines are. And has pretty consistently followed through enforcing those red lines. Now, we may not like that. We may regard it as an intolerable violation of Georgia and Ukraine's sovereignty. But given Russia and given its ability to act in this way and its immunity to our sanctions in large part, because it has very substantial foreign currency reserves and very substantial resources in its economy, we would be, you know, well advised to take this clearly announced policy seriously.
Hmm. Okay. We're told that we've recovered. This has been a long, long recovery. The employment numbers are the best now in more than a decade. The stock market continues, climbing. But wealth inequality and low wages still have me convinced that the global economy is not as healthy as we're told. And there are people like me who, I don't care how good the stock market is doing, my house is still in foreclosure. So, I think it's a pretty, tenuous recovery in some senses. Again, this comes from my non-economist mind.
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, that's an absolutely accurate description, I think, of our situation.
Uh-huh.
Somewhat less than half of Americans actually own any shares, any equity.
Mm-hmm.
So the S&P 500 is completely irrelevant to them. And of the group that do, the slightly less than half that do earn equity, the vast majority is concentrated in the hands of the top 1% or so. So wealth inequality has been hugely increased by the surge in the S&P 500. This does not benefit the majority of Americans in any significant way. And labor market participation is down. And the minority communities in the United States, African-American and Latinos, suffered hits to their wealth, which is basically real estate, which are irreparable. They're very unlikely ever to make them good in the next generation or possibly even beyond. So that's permanent scarring. And the effect of a labor market shock lasts as well. You know, young people who lose that entrance into the labor market at a crucial point don't ever get those years back. You don't get to be 21 or 22, freshly out of college or community college again, right?
Right.
So there's no do-overs for them, and that experience is one that they will carry with them, and that insecurity for the rest of their lives. So all things are relative, and a lot of the time, economists use rate of change kind of indicators to show, you know, progress without thinking all that hard about the levels. And if you look at the state of the American economy today, even though it's growing reasonably quickly now, if you ask yourself where it would have been if there hadn't been a recession and it had simply grown at the pace it was growing in 2007 and 2008, we would be trillions of dollars better off collectively than we are today.
Right.
Because the American economy is now growing at its previous rate, but did not make up the losses that it suffered before 2008.
Uh-huh. Now the entire, just as the global economy crashed after our crash, the recovery was also a global event. The reason I'm asking is because now, Donald Trump likes to take credit for the great economy we allegedly have.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there's a lot more, there are global factors at work here. And it seems to me what he's doing with the tariffs and the rolling back of Dodd-Frank and other regulations,
mm-hmm.
and trade, that he's bound and determined to crash it again. I'm wondering how secure is the economy, because the global economy seems to be doing okay right now.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump's claims about his, authorship of America's current prosperity should be, it's just cheap politics. And then,
yes.
What one shouldn't expect any more from a man whose character. It's nonsense. And insofar as the American economy is growing particularly rapidly earlier this year, it's because of the enormous tax cuts which the Republicans pushed through in the end of 2017, which, as we all know, are hugely inequitable and benefit better off Americans even more than they already were benefiting. So that element of the story. Yes, the global economy has recovered reasonably well. Global trade, it has to be said, has never resumed its rapid growth of the pre-crisis period. The Chinese economy has continued to grow fast, but increasingly relying essentially on internal growth. And the Eurozone, Europe, has had a lamentable period, not really beginning to recover at all until 2014, 2015 at the earliest, with unemployment rates in places like Spain for young people as high as 50%. So Europe is the place where if you wanted to show the permanent scarring, that's really where you would look.
Wow.
Italy has had barely any growth since 2008, 2009. And the trade war that Donald Trump has sort of gratuitously launched us into
doesn't help. I don't think it's the prelude to a new disaster. No. International trade is not the same kind of trigger for crisis that a financial crisis is. A financial crisis is really like a stroke or a heart attack. It suddenly stops basically all your metabolic function. It shuts you down. Whereas the impediments to trade that Donald Trump is putting up is more like, you know, creeping arthritis or something like that. It progressively slows you down, diminishes your enjoyment of life, limits your opportunities, but it doesn't cause an immediate debt. It is not, you know, it's not immediately fatal in the way that a comprehensive banking crisis like 2008 was.
Right.
It certainly doesn't help, but
right.
It's not the same kind of problem.
But he could be subjecting us to, you know, death by a thousand cuts here with the little, I mean, the things that he's doing one on top of another between, you know, getting into a trade war with China and you know, putting tariffs on steel and then the rolling back of regulations that were there to protect us. Dodd-Frank was put in place after the 2008 crash to protect us from something like this happening again, and they are basically they're undoing Dodd-Frank. So how uncomfortable do you feel with Donald Trump being the guy in the Oval Office for the next couple of years?
I'm sensing that we may agree that we were all extremely uncomfortable with this scenario for so many different reasons. I agree with everything you've said. I mean, what's remarkable about the trade policy is it's so difficult to identify who actually are the beneficiaries. I mean, classically, back in the 19th century, in the old days of American high tariffs, you could point to a constituency they were good for. And it was a big constituency, and it mattered. And the extraordinary thing about Donald Trump's trade policy is that it's really symbolic. It does seem to be about satisfying the impulse of some of his voters to be at war with somebody in some way, to be fighting back against trends and ominous developments in the global economy they see. They like to see, you know, their commander-in-chief calling out some other enemy of America in economic terms. It's very difficult to point to any net benefit of any substantial kind. I mean, of course, there's going to be, you know, there are some aluminium producers in the United States who are better off, but it's a tiny industry in the United States. And I gather that Alcoa, which is the largest aluminium producer in the U.S., has actually had to apply for an exemption because its business is so deeply integrated with Canada that it can't actually function under the Trump tariff regime. So the Trump tariffs are really a symbolic thing. Dodd-Frank is, I think, much more serious. And I would entirely agree with you that the gutting of Dodd-Frank is an extremely dangerous development. It was unfortunately built in as a possibility to Dodd-Frank because Dodd-Frank is basically just the legislative framework. It doesn't actually specify the content of the regulations that they're required to make. And that was done deliberately by Tim Geithner as Treasury Secretary to minimize the ability of Congress to influence decision-making by technical and expert regulators. And now, of course, with a very different, you know, administration, with a very different set of motives and a different set of connections in American business, that means that behind the scenes, without them ever repealing Dodd-Frank, you can nevertheless effectively eviscerate it and render it ineffectual as a mechanism for reducing risk. And the banks are irresponsible enough to go along with a policy which could indeed, in the long run, put them in harm's way. I don't think of it as an immediate threat, but over the medium term, one would be asking, you know, where are the new risks building up as the regulations are loosened?
Yes, and that seems to be the question right now because, you know, the stock market was on a roll for a while there, and then it sort of slowed down when Trump started in with his trade deals. But it's hovering around 25,000-26,000 for the Dow. But there are those of us who keep almost just waiting for the other shoe to drop, wondering when it's going to crash again. How healthy is the global economy today, or do you see more troubles on the horizon?
I think the global economy is, it was actually going through a period of quite generally synchronized growth 6 to 12 months ago. As far as the global business cycle is concerned, the one entity that matters most is China, which is currently responsible for as much of global growth as the United States and Europe put together. So, you know, for the future prospects of the global economy, what matters really is the ability of the Chinese authorities to control the extraordinary buildup of credit and industrial capacity that we've seen there over the last 10 to 15 years. And, you know, this is something that is untested. They're engaged in an experiment as radical as anything we've ever seen in economic history.
Adam, I'm sorry to cut you off. We're just out of time. People have to read the book, Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Thank you so much for joining us today and educating me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure being on your show. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take care.